I always have a feeling that we can acquire, if you want, the different alphabets in a subconscious way without having to memorize them, right? So, for example, when it comes to Japanese or Mandarin or Korean, if the teacher tells you a story, a simple one that you can understand, you know, through images, gestures, and so on, and I don't know, a couple of classes later, when you're already familiar with the story, you read the characters, you read the story at the same time as the teacher's telling it as well. Like naturally, on a subconscious way, you're going to acquire those characters without having to memorize them. Because, like you said, 2,000, 3,000, 10,000, that sounds crazy to me, like having to memorize that. Hi, Bong.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, and thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, it's my pleasure, actually. I'm really happy to have you here. And yeah, to get things started, yes. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience with languages, your long experience with languages, as far as I know, right? And
Well, it's relative,
like
I think it
anything that you think is relevant, like when you got started with languages first, and was there a moment in which you realized something wasn't working the way you wanted, things like that?
Yeah. So in my case, it's a little different because it started in my family. So I
Okay.
was born in France, but my mother's Japanese. So my first language is Japanese is the first language I've ever spoken with my mother, with my little sister and little brother. And yeah, so that part is natural. And sometimes people usually they say native tongue or mother tongue, and it's a synonym. But for me, there's a distinction because I was born in France. I usually say that my native tongue is French, and my mother tongue is Japanese because my mother is literally Japanese. And so after that, I went to school in France, and so French became my most efficient, most fluent language. And so today I speak English, French, and Japanese. And so English, of course, like most of the people in the world, I guess, I started studying it in school, in middle school. And so yeah, it was just like regular going to classes. I had the privilege to go to the UK back in the days. So this part of the process. But I think what you're referring to is for most people watching your and my YouTube channel would be how to study by ourselves or maybe with a tutor. So that I it's interesting because after that I started learning. So in high school in France, we're introduced to Spanish and or German. In my case, I studied both. And then after that, at university, I studied international business with my language of study being Korean. So I went to Korea for 6 months as an exchange student. So it was very, very focused on classes, like the regular courses of going to a class, whether in high school or at university. But by myself, like most of us, I studied also with language learning apps. I studied with one-on-one lessons. And I think the most challenging part is being disciplined and also staying motivated. I think that, that's the most difficult part. And to be honest, sometimes people pay so much money, like hundreds of dollars, to take classes, to pay for the best tutors, to pay for the best teachers or coaches, and to be honest, sometimes they have the feeling that the more money or the more time, well, time is different, but the more money you spend, the more it's going to be magical, and you'll start learning, like you'll become fluent in no time. But to be honest, at the end of the day, I think it's people should know that it's about like you're the only one learning, so you have to put in the effort. And so, of course, it's going to take time, but it also you'll need to focus on the learning actively. And this, to be honest, is maybe the part that's most difficult for most of the people, and myself included.
Right. Yeah, it's like keep getting exposed to the language on your own. Even if you're attending classes, right? Not just settle for that hour or two a week.
Yeah.
But, you know, listen to podcasts that you can understand, of course. Reading books, you know, any activity that you enjoy doing, because that's another part to me, that if you're enjoying the process, it's going to be easier to sustain that motivation that you talked about, right? Or even find the time to keep getting exposed to the language.
Absolutely.
As opposed to, you know, traditional classes, you know, grammar study and so on, which in my opinion, sooner or later, you're going to end up giving up, because there might be some people who enjoy that, but
there is a part where, because I believe you still need to understand a little bit of the basic grammar in a language. So I would personally start by learning the grammar and very, very basic expressions on how to introduce myself and things like that. But at some point, like, you know, if you know enough of the basic grammar, then it's time to go out, because you could spend hours and hours and hundreds of hours learning about grammar, but you're going to have to be in that position, survival position, where you're facing a native speaker and you have to communicate. Mm-hmm. And even if you like studied for hundreds of hours or only 10 hours, it's going to be the same kind of, oh, what do I say? And, you know, the process of, oh, I'm freaking out and I have to find my words. And it comes with practice, and you're going to make mistake, and you're going to, like, there's going to be a lot of awkward moments when you don't know what to say, when you don't know what to do, when you're going to make mistakes, when you think you heard something and you use it in a different context, that it means something else. And of course, sometimes it's also like the beauty of languages. You'll learn something in a country and you go to another country that speaks the same language, and they use the word differently. Mm-hmm. For example, in Spain, we say coger el autobús. And if you go to Mexico, it makes people laugh. So that's part of the learning process. And in general, this is kind of the kind of mistakes you'll make, which is part of the fun of learning a language. And it's also through these experiences that you're not going to forget about the mistakes or the language itself, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah, I was thinking, when it comes to your first experience with English, do you remember how it was? Or do you remember, because, you know, your, again, mother tongue or native tongue were French and Japanese, right? So you started learning English, because I've talked about it several times, I mean, many times, but in my case, I studied English in school, high school, you know, throughout the whole education system for nearly 15 years. And I could pass any grammar exam, but I just couldn't speak the language. It's that simple.
That is true. And that's exactly, it's pretty much the same thing as I was saying before. Reading, listening, writing, you know, it's a certain skill, and it's a set of skills. And you can take time, you know, even when you type, because, you know, when I was in Korea, before actually speaking, being able to speak the language and reaching that intermediate level, I would text a lot of friends I would make there. And texting was not a problem. You know, I would just write things and I could take the time to think about the sentences. Sometimes I would cheat a little bit, go to the dictionary. Mm-hmm. But in general, I knew things and I had the luxury of taking the time and being relaxed and rereading myself and rewriting if needed. But speaking takes it to a whole different level, and not necessarily level, because you can say very easy things, but you don't have the same flexibility in making mistakes, and it has to be on spot, and you don't want to be reflecting too much, because the person you're speaking to is waiting for your answer. Exactly. So I think it brings a whole lot, you know, more stress and anxiety. But that's the thing. At the end of the day, most of the people watching us want to reach that level, or want to speak the language and not being able to read it or to understand it. And as a French speaker, for me, like Spanish or Italian or Portuguese, if I read a book, I'm able to understand maybe 70-75% of everything that's written, because of the Latin roots and stuff.
Yep.
But speaking is completely different. And even like I was studying Spanish, and now my understanding of Spanish is pretty decent, I'd say. But I would not understand Brazilian Portuguese. Once I understood the phonemes that, for example, the affricate sounds, like for DE, so in Spanish it's D, but in Brazilian Portuguese it's G. And then you start connecting everything. It's like, oh, now I understand. But it takes listening. And then after that, you know, of course you listen and then you have to speak. That's where I'm at for Portuguese, reflecting, going like cheating with Spanish. Yeah. But as you mentioned, same for me in school, because obviously, you know, you're maybe 30 in the class and the teacher cannot spend the amount of time testing each pupil or each student. So, but that being said, no, there was one who was very, very, very emphasizing on the oral expression ability, and she would record us, and that was part of the test. We had microphones. We had an actual class with microphones and headsets, and at the same time, everybody would take the test at the same time, and would listen and speak, and she would correct that at home. So I think that was very efficient in my personal learning. But in my case for English at school, I was obviously very passionate about language learning already. I was passionate about the American culture, the British culture. I would watch movies. I would listen to punk rock songs and study the lyrics. I would also learn guitar. So it was like two in one combo. Right. So that helps for sure. Yeah, I guess it's like, if I compare myself with all the other students who didn't really care about language learning, it was different. And in my case, also my parents, I don't know if they understood the importance of learning languages, but they sent me to summer camps in other countries, in Germany, in the UK. So that I'm really, really happy about and grateful today.
Right. Yeah, that was part of it for sure. Like, yeah, in my case, it's funny because now it's you know, one of my biggest passions, like learning languages and getting to know people from other cultures and so on. But I remember going through high school and all that period that I talked about and just feeling like, because not because of the language itself, but because it wasn't fun. You know, it was all about grammar exercises and things of that nature. Yeah. So, I thought of English in that case as something that I had to pass. I said, one more subject that I had to pass. So I never thought about it about, of course, so I want to learn English so I can communicate. You know, let's say that the world, teachers, school, whatever you want to call it, didn't make it interesting enough for me. Yeah. And now I realize that it's actually one of my biggest passions. So, but also, in my case, like both my parents are Spanish, but my mom, she was a French teacher in college, and we used to go to France, to the south of France, at least once every summer, to meet a family, because my mom has friends there in France, in Bordeaux, south of France.
Nice.
So even though, you know, I wasn't that interested in languages throughout the whole education period, maybe those earlier experiences in France, whereas most of my friends would just still, you know, would just stay in Spain or go somewhere on the beach in Spain, you know, instill something in me that manifested like 20 years later, as opposed to right away. But, you know, I always think about those earlier experiences.
Yeah. Help you. I had a question about, because so you mentioned being from Spain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which part of Spain?
I'm from a little town in Castilla y León. Do you know the regions?
Yeah.
So it's like hour and a half west of Zaragoza, a couple of hours north of Madrid. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's called Soria, by the way, but it's a small town.
Yeah, but I'm curious about the culture there, because what doesn't help? So, of course, you mentioned a teacher not being able to motivate the student, and you know, that's also not really fair, because we didn't have a choice. We had to take all the lessons, history lessons. We had to take literature lessons. language lessons, what else, maths and stuff like that. We don't have a choice, and the choice comes after. So it's a bit sad, but in France, what happened is that in class, we didn't really like success. There is this culture of jealousy, maybe. Okay. And if someone was too good, especially orally, so when you take tests, it's okay. You know, you just write things. And then maybe when people see that you had a good grade, then they'll be jealous. But the worst part for me was when the teacher would call me out and say, okay, could you repeat that sentence in English? And if I said it well, then everybody would be like, oh man, you're showing off. Like you're a show off. Like, don't even try. Like, and then you would start losing friends. I don't know if it's the same in Spain or in different countries, but there is like this kind of mentality which could prevent you from performing well. And in your case, in my case, we traveled, and I think that's a central part in my personal language journey, because as mentioned, I went to different summer camps in other countries, Germany, the UK, and if I didn't speak English, at least I couldn't communicate with other people. So it was a necessity. So in my case, it was a bit different, but I'm curious to know a bit more about how it is, because I mean, there are two countries right next to each other, so maybe the culture might be similar, but still.
Yeah, I can remember a similar dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, we were talking about English, in my case, but we could talk about pretty much any subject, to be honest. Like, yeah. And I don't really, this is not a, you know, how to put it into words, like, I'm not trying to criticize the teachers themselves. It's just the whole system. You know, that's,
yeah.
I'm always talking about the system, no individual teachers. They're going to do the best job they can, right?
Yeah.
It's just the whole, let's memorize things to, you know, sort of spit it out in an exam and let's all forget about it, you know, a week later. And just, you know, the whole system is based on you passing subjects, getting to the next year.
Yeah.
And whether you learn something or not, that's up to you.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because
the whole concept. So it wasn't interesting for me. It was just one more subject. You know, I just had to study enough to get passing grades, and that's it.
Yeah, you're right. No, because it's you mentioning that, and it reminds me that even in high school, there were teachers, because teachers have to follow and as you mentioned, it's again the system, but they have to follow a program. Yeah. And I remember one teacher, a history teacher, I didn't particularly like history at the time. Now I'm fascinated about it, but he didn't care about the program. So he would just like, we were given a book by the school, and he didn't even care about the book. So he would tell the lesson as a story. He was a very good storyteller, and we can't expect that from everybody. And it's the same, you know, at work. Sometimes, like, you have office meetings and you have to give numbers and stuff, and you'll have people who are naturally, or maybe who worked on their eloquence, on their charisma, and they know how to speak. So even just giving random numbers, they'll tell a story, and you'll just be captivated by it for 20 minutes, and sometimes even more, an hour. So it's the same for teachers. Right. Maybe like training teachers, that could be part of the process, you know, classes about how to public speak, being a public speaker, how to be more eloquent and things like that. Is it really fair or not? Because some people are more shy, maybe, but should it be a necessity when you apply for a teaching job? That could be a good question, but you're right. So this teacher, this history teacher, I'll remember for the rest of my life because he was just so good. But how would you say teachers could do to make students more motivated? In my case, the way I love learning languages is through songs, movies, TV shows. So my lessons would only be like that. Would it follow the program? Maybe not. Would my students be more willing to speak or to travel? Maybe, I don't know. Again, I'm not a certified teacher and I don't want to disrespect the job, but it's a very tough question, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about out of the system classes, I have plenty of ideas. Actually, like, I teach Spanish myself.
Yeah. So,
but within the system, it's just, it's tough because again, back to the point, it's not about teacher. Like they do the best job that they can, but when you, like, it's funny because you were talking about history. It was pretty similar to me with philosophy.
Okay.
Like, now I love it. Like I love, you know, learning about, you know, just asking you questions about life, like asking yourself questions about life, thinking about, you know, it's just fascinating to me. But I remember the couple of years that I studied philosophy in high school, it was all about, you know, memorizing dates and, I don't know, accomplishments, if you will. So, but I might be learning the same things that I'm learning now on my own by watching YouTube videos, but because the whole concept is you need to remember this to pass an exam, I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't enjoying it. I wasn't there to understand their ideas, which is what I do now when I watch a YouTube video, right?
Yeah.
So it might be exactly the same content, but because of the approach, because of the system, it just makes it all so much different. So that's why I said that within the traditional formal system, you know, with the curriculums and, like you said, it just, to me, there's no way. But we have the internet, so I'm fine with it.
yeah.
Obviously, like you said, out of that system, outside of that system, so I use storytelling a lot, games, a lot of ideas, you know, but because you don't have the pressure of having to adjust to, you know, curriculum, to, it's just, yeah.
But absolutely.
We could go on and on with this.
Of course. I mean, I would like to go back to what you said about being tested, because it's something that for me, I don't want to criticize the Asian culture about it, but my mother was very strict about me having very good grades. And so that would put a lot of pressure on my shoulders, especially being the eldest in my family. I had to show, you know, the model, to be a role model for my little siblings. And I would be so stressed out and anxious before an exam. And I mentioned that when you're in front of a native speaker, you have that pressure, which could be maybe, in my case, the result of the whole system. But in the end, having that experience, you know that it's no big deal, because in the system, however, you want to apply for university, then your grades are going to be important to do that. So there is a direct consequence. But while learning languages, it's fine. You make mistakes. You didn't conjugate something. In Spanish, subjunctive is a nightmare for me. You didn't use the subjunctive in a sentence. That's fine. Maybe the person's going to correct you and say, okay, but she understood what I said, or he understood what I said. But like, it's fine. Nobody's grading you. So I think that's also very, very important for people who come from like similar cultures as ours. Don't freak out too much. Just speak the language and make mistakes. And that's fine, you know?
Yeah, that's important, because I heard that about like Japanese, Korean culture. Yeah, it's true. Like I don't know it myself, obviously, but it's to me it's the same idea, but maybe in those cultures it's even crazier, right? Or there's even more pressure, like you said. But it's just, yeah, it's the whole like parents, teachers, you know, the system itself, society. They just put so much pressure on kids when it's not gonna affect their future at all. I remember my time, like when I was in high school, just feeling the pressure of how to put it into words, like it was gonna determine my life. You know what I mean? When I always talk about the fact that everything that I know today, I'd say 99.9% of it, I've learned it myself afterwards. Yeah. When I say myself, is I look for it myself. I might need a tutor, or I might want you to be, I need someone else to explain it to me, but I look for it myself. That's what I mean. And then I actually studied economics in college, and I'm a Spanish language teacher now. So it didn't determine my life at all.
Yeah.
So that's the whole thing. And like you said, when you're learning languages on your own as an adult, because of the fun, you know, for the fun of it, because you enjoy it, obviously you're going to make mistakes all the time, but you don't have that pressure. It's not going to determine, for example, you know, I'm, people who are trying to learn English for job or for work purposes, they have kind of the same pressure because they feel like they need that, right? So then they don't enjoy the process much. They're looking for shortcuts because they need it as fast as possible. So you get into similar dynamics, right?
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I know people like that who have to learn language for the job, especially here in Montreal, where I live. It's a bilingual city. And for immigration purposes, you need to learn French because it's a French-speaking province. Right. And I know that a lot of people are taking French classes and they struggle so much. But I think deep inside, they don't want to. They take the classes and they take the exams because they have to. Yep. A similar case is a friend of mine who's married to someone who speaks French. They speak English together. She's American, but she wants to communicate with his family. And so she's learning French, and it's the same. Like, she's struggling so much. So either these people don't truly want to learn language, and it's fine. You know, we all have different tastes and priorities, right? Or could there be a way for them to learn more efficiently? So for me, I found the path, which is movies, TV shows, songs, and it would, you know, it's content that I like. But let's say I marry someone from a country where there's not that many movies. What am I going to do? Maybe I'll be in trouble then. But I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, being married to someone from that country, I think it adds a level of attractiveness to learning the language. But in general, in my opinion, that works for languages and for anything in life. To me, if you're not learning it because you truly want to learn it, in the long run, it's not going to work. Like, I always talk about it. For me, it's even in the short run. But I'm back to what I said. Like, you know, we, all the subjects that we learn in school, there was plenty of different subjects, plenty of different topics. I didn't care about any of them. Yeah, I mean, gym, I always love sports. But, but right now, like, languages, I love them. Philosophy, history. There's so many things I love right now. So, but now I want to learn them myself. I'm not forced to learn them to pass an exam. Or so even if it's like a really practical thing that you need for immigration purposes, like you said, it's a bit more interesting, or not interesting is not the word. The motivation can be a little bit higher because you need it, but it's still not your choice. Yeah. Right. So, but back to what you said, if you marry someone from a country with no movies or very, you know, very few movies and so on. I mean, this idea of trash talk, I don't know if you're familiar with it, that is like a language exchange, but in which both people speak in the native language. So, you know, if you're living with that person, you can communicate to each other in your native languages, but in a way that is comprehensible for the other person, especially at the beginning, if you're starting from scratch, right? Because, so you're living together, so I'm just going to take a shower, you know, plenty of gestures and
right,
actually going into the bathroom and, you know, turning the water on. So making it comprehensible for the other person. And that way, it doesn't feel like learning at the same time, which is awesome, because obviously you have the, you want those resources that you use to help you learn the language as well, but you enjoy them, right? You would watch them in your native language.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in a way, it doesn't feel like learning.
Exactly.
Right. So that's kind of the idea. Whereas if you're learning a language for, you know, to pass an exam, to get a certificate, it feels like learning too much, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's.
But yeah, but in my case, maybe it's a little different. And I'm working on maybe developing a method to learn, because I'm a performer, I'm an entertainer. And when I hear something in a language, I want to say it and right. and master the accent to the extent where, because from my experience, of course, I took theater classes and things like that. And sometimes I take acting gigs. But from my experience, outside of that, every time I meet someone from a country that is not a widely known language, like English, Chinese, you know, these huge languages in the world, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and I say something perfectly, then there is something magical happening. They like their eyes get bigger and they're like, oh my God, that was so good. How do you know that? And it's not like, it's usually not going to be like very practical sentences like, hello, how are you? It's going to be like, I don't know. Hey, would you like to dance with me, for example? So wait, hold on. Because I think I approached someone, a Ukrainian person. I said that. Let me try to see if I remember. I think that's how you say, would you like to dance with me? Mm-hmm. And back in the days when I met that person and I said that, she started laughing so much. So now whenever I watch something on TV and I repeat it, the script with native speakers or even people who just watch the show, it's just so funny because people know the reference. And sometimes even in your own mother tongue, you only speak one language, you're a fan of a movie and you learn the script of a very famous quote. Yep. And you say, people will know. And so through movies, you learn the language, you learn the culture, you learn like many things. And well, that's my approach at least. And I'm not saying that thanks to that, I'll be able to be fluent in the language, but I think it's a good start.
Right. No, I mean, movies are great, like no question. The only little issue is if you're starting from scratch, it's not going to be too comprehensive.
Of course.
But yeah. But you need to adjust to your level of understanding, obviously, right?
Yeah. But that's also funny because, so you mentioned podcasts, for example, which is obviously way more, it's richer in terms of content. And especially you're going to listen to a podcast that's specialized on, about a subject like philosophy or whatever. But it's funny because even if you don't understand everything, sometimes you can get a transcription of the podcast or the episode. And you can learn new words through that. So it's going to be a bit more active learning, but I think it can only be good for you to understand the language better.
Right. Yeah. And then there's one interesting dynamic with podcasts because a couple of years ago, I was a bit reluctant to use them because there's no visual help, right?
Yeah.
But I realized that even people who create podcasts, like for native speakers, right? Not people who are trying to teach language, but for native speakers, subconsciously when you're creating a podcast, because like the content creator, because you know there's not going to be a video, you know, people tend to speak in a little bit slower, like really speak in a clear way, you know? Yeah. So it's easier to understand than I thought. And then obviously there's so many of them about any topic that you can think of. So that's, yeah.
No, it's very relevant. And it's, as content creators, well, I don't know how you see it, but for me, sometimes I was thinking about maybe transforming YouTube videos into podcasts, which would be very easy, basically. Like recording new stuff to introduce the podcast, the episode itself. But the format is a little different. So on YouTube, you want to grab the attention. So you will speak a bit faster. You want it to be dynamic. Whereas podcasts, you know that people are going to be maybe listening for 20, 30 minutes. They're in their car, in the traffic, they're at home, they want to relax, they want to close their eyes, they want to focus on a subject. So the format is completely different. And as you said, if I were to start a podcast, I would be in front of my microphone, focused, and I would speak slower. Because it's just different, and that's also very relevant for people who are learning a language, going for podcasts. But again, I love podcasts too, usually for very specific subjects like technology and maybe philosophy or just sociology and things like that. And videos and music will be more for entertainment purposes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's some formats that you can use for both, like this one we're doing, like an interview style. You can use it for both YouTube and
podcast,
right? Because you're not overacting to grab people's attention, like a like your YouTube video, right? Like a 5, 6, 7 minute video, or and you're we're speaking, and you know we're talking about a topic that people might be interested in, so we could, you could just extract the audio and make it into a podcast, right?
Absolutely.
But yeah, I you know, it was fascinating because I was listening to podcasts in languages that I could understand well, like English or Italian or Portuguese or French, but languages like Polish, because I live in Poland, I wasn't doing that because I thought it's not going to be comprehensible, right? But now it is.
Oh.
And some of the things that I noticed was that you know, consciously or subconsciously, content creators, like we talked about, they speak slower when you're in front of the microphone because you don't have the visual help. So you make it, you want to make yourself understood. And I'm really curious about one thing, because obviously your mom's Japanese, like you said, and I've seen some of your like latest videos. You talked about the alphabets or the three systems, right? And I'm super curious about, like, I've talked about it with several people, and because I'm super curious about the part of learning how to read or how to write in languages like Japanese or Mandarin, Korean, and so on. Because you're more of an expert in Japanese, and that's a perfect example because of the three different systems, right? But people, I haven't started my journey with Japanese yet, but I've talked to people who have native speakers, and obviously trying to memorize the one that's like thousands of characters, it's crazy, obviously. But people always talk about, you know, trying to figure them out by their meaning. I think that's for Mandarin. I don't know if it works the same way with Japanese, but like, so this is the symbol of the character for a person. This is so you put them together and it means something similar or something related.
Yeah.
Or you combine two ideas and it makes a new character, things like that. But I'm curious about how you as a kid learned the different alphabets.
Okay. So
how do you learn to write and
where to start? So about my channel, it's difficult to right now. My channel is a bit of in a transition. So I'm creating these resources to learn French and Japanese. To learn them from scratch, but it's more like a motivational push. People, especially for people I know personally, who keep asking me, can you teach me Japanese or can you teach me French? I decided to create these resources, maybe extend it to an online course in the near future for absolute beginners. And then after that, they can come back on my channel and I'll be studying with movies, TV shows on a platform called Lingopie. Mm-hmm. And about the Japanese alphabet, you know, it's funny because for foreigners who are used to the Latin alphabet, it's crazy to remember all these thousands and thousands of characters. But if you think about it, and maybe it might not be that, like to that extent, but conjugation for Asian speakers, you have to remember like the each person. Mm-hmm. And past, future, whereas in China or in Japan, it's just going to be one thing you add to the verb for every person, right? Plus, I mentioned the subjunctive in Spanish. In French, we also have subjunctive in the past, subjunctive in the present, etc. So I think the difficulty is different. So in the case of Japanese, it comes down to Chinese characters. There's actually a really good book. Do I have it nearby? Maybe not. Anyway, so sorry about that. So it's a friend of mine whose name is Emmanuel Turnon, and he studied Chinese characters. So there is the traditional Chinese characters that are still used in some part of China. And it was simplified in Japan. It was simplified in China in different ways. Most of them are still the same, though, today. And yes, originally, they like you have parts of the character and they can be by themselves. So, for example, day is going to be written a certain way. Moon, which is also the character for a month because it was a lunar calendar before, is going to be written a different way. And you can take these characters and make it smaller to create different characters. So that's the essence of how character creating characters work in Chinese. So it was imported in Japan, and back in the days, also in Korea, Chinese characters, traditional characters, were used to communicate on a written format. And in Japan, they simplified it to two different alphabets called the kana. And so there is hiragana, katakana, which was basically Chinese characters simplified. So that's the basic history of the three alphabets, why there's three alphabets in Japanese. In Korea, they don't use the Chinese characters anymore in daily life. Sometimes they do in a few specific cases, but if you in terms of how it sounds, sometimes you can use that to learn the three languages more efficiently. Anyways, so in Chinese, you obviously have to learn a lot more characters because thanks to the two other alphabets, in Japanese, you don't. So I think you have to know maybe 2,000 to 3,000 characters in Japanese. And it could be like three, four, five times more in Chinese to have a general knowledge of the language. It's a lot, I'll give you that, it's a lot. But and to be honest, I don't know them all by heart. Sometimes I have to cheat. I have to type it on my phone and it's gonna show the character and I'll recognize it. Oh yeah, that's the one, and I'll write like that. So how I started learning the writing system was when I was a child. My mom, who was a teacher, actually, she taught me the first one, hiragana, then she taught me the second one, and I went to Japanese school, even in France. So I would go to the regular French system, and during the weekend, I would follow the Japanese cursus, but only for the language. And I stopped that in middle school because it was just too much. But I, again, it was through classes, so very standard.
Right,
like general institutional classes,
like continuous learning, and
yeah. But then after that, later on at university, I started learning the language again. So restudying all the characters because I wanted to read manga.
Right,
and after that, I started watching anime again, and I wanted to have the Japanese subtitles. And it's written with the Chinese characters so that I could learn new Chinese characters and new words. Sometimes there are words that you just forgot, especially scientific terms. Like if you watch anime about, I don't know, medical things, you can learn new like body parts and stuff like that. So, of course, I know how to say head. I know how to say legs and stuff. But then like specific muscles and things like that, it's very interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I'm always asking about it is because obviously I, you know, my native language is Spanish, so that's like the Latin alphabet, right? And up until I started learning Russian a couple of years ago, all the languages that I've learned had the same alphabet. I mean, Polish has a couple of three letters that are a little bit different, but still the same alphabet. But when I started with Russian, I realized that, well, actually, I started watching videos on YouTube and on a channel called Comprehensible Russian. And I've talked about this many times, but she creates comprehensible videos for people who are even starting from scratch, right? And she talks about like Russian culture, Russian cities, but she makes it interesting as well. And I remember in some of her videos, she had a map of Europe and the names of the countries in the Cyrillic alphabet in Russian. And within the context of her explanation of the culture, whatever she was talking about, I perfectly remember she talked about France and Finland, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, so that little ball with a stick, that's our F sound, right? Because it was the first letter at the beginning of France and Finland.
She
would say them at the same time. So that's why I always have a feeling that we can acquire, if you want, the different alphabets in a subconscious way without having to memorize them, right? So for example, when it comes to Japanese or Mandarin or Korean, if the teacher tells you a story, a simple one that you can understand, you know, through images, gestures, and so on, and I don't know, a couple of classes later, when you're already familiar with the story, you read the characters, you read the story at the same time as the teacher's telling it as well, like naturally on a subconscious way, you're going to acquire those characters without having to memorize them. Because like you said, 2,000, 3,000, 10,000, that sounds crazy to me, like having to memorize that. You know what I mean? So that's why I'm always curious about that specific part of languages, but like languages with different alphabets. Like,
you're right.
I feel like there must be an easier way.
Yeah, right. Well,
or less painful, maybe not easier, but less painful.
For sure. I mean, what you say is very relevant in the sense that, of course, with comprehensible input, it's going to help you learn the language, no doubt about it. But so first of all, the meaning of a character that becomes a key in a different character, that's going to help you remember that character. But once you know it, you're not going to remember, or you're not going to make it's not going to be conscious every time. Oh yeah, this character of the sun is in this character, and so that means that. So that's more the philosophy of the language, so that's fine. However, one thing that's very important to note in when it comes to learning reading and writing Chinese characters, because again, like in Spanish, you're not going to forget the alphabet, right? And when I write in French, I am letters is not going to be a problem. I know them by heart, and I can write them, like maybe not say them the whole alphabet backwards, but I know the letters. In Japanese, as I mentioned, it's a bit more tricky in the sense that maybe Japanese people tend to remember all of them, but I think sometimes, well, I personally struggle to remember. If I'm asked to write something, I would need to cheat and look for the character if it's something that I don't use on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Also, something that's different is the stroke order. That's very important because there is a specific order to write the character. So you can't write from right to left. It's got to be from left to right, usually from top to bottom. And every stroke, you'll have to respect the order. So at some point when you're learning a new character, you'll have to know the stroke order. Otherwise, it's not going to be proper and people might not be able to properly read you, maybe. That being said, if you know how to write the character for the moon, for example, and it's in another character, then you know how to write already. So like that's half of the work done. So the more characters you'll know, the more it's going to be easier and natural. But when you start learning maybe the first 500 characters, you'll have to write them on a sheet of paper like you do when you learn a new alphabet and remember the stroke order. That's my perspective.
I get it. It's just, obviously, but writing is a completely different animal because that's even more difficult. Like it's the same like understanding and speaking. You're always going to be able to understand more than you can say, right?
Of course.
It's the way it works. Same for reading and writing, because writing is output. It's more complicated. It comes later.
Yeah.
But so what my point is, if you know the story because the teacher has explained it to you, you've talked about that specific, like a simple one, I don't know, an elephant going to the park, just making that up. If a couple of classes later, she or he, the teacher, reads it, And you see the character at the same time as she or he is telling it, you know, my idea is like your brain is going to pick up everything, like the different, of course, you need to get exposure to it, like exposure to the words and the sentences many times. It's not that you're going to read it once and that's it. It doesn't work that way, you know. But if, you know, the elephant goes to the park, the elephant goes to the zoo, the elephant eats ice cream, the elephant has a friend from Canada, whatever. You see the word elephant many times as, you know, and the teacher saying it at the same time. So subconsciously, without you paying conscious attention, oh, so you're going to remember, oh, so that's the one. So when you read it again, you know that's the elephant.
Of course.
It doesn't mean you can write it down.
Yeah.
That comes even farther along, right? But my point is, there must be a more natural way to acquire it. That's what I'm trying to figure out, right? That's why I'm asking this question to different people, because that's you know, I want to get to that point in which I understand that.
Of course, but I mean, that's very interesting, because there are some methods of learning Chinese which completely get rid of the writing system. So basically, it's just about listening and speaking. So if you didn't want to learn Chinese, how to write and read Chinese, which is up to you, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at some point, if you go there and you're not able to read the signs and you speak like you can speak on an intermediate level and not able to read anything, that might handicap you. But it's possible. Yes, if you don't want to read and write Chinese, there are methods to only speak and understand and listen. So yeah, that's for sure. Go for it if you know, remembering 5,000 characters is an issue for you, then maybe the method is more suited for your needs, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I've also talked about it that, to me personally, like anything that resembles or that reminds me of the traditional high school classes, I just hate it. So it's, you know, I might be too extreme at times, but because anything that reminds me of conscious traditional learning of a language or whatever it is, it just, you know, I just reject it. Subconsciously. But I don't know, I just, because getting back to my example with Russian, I started noticing little things like the one I just mentioned. And, you know, other words, like I remember it was auto service, like, you know, like the gas station and things like that. So, okay, so I started to figure it out. But I was listening to that person, to that woman that I talked about, telling the story and reading the signs at the same time. So it's like you make the connections without even realizing on the conscious level, right? And so little by little, I started reading more and more in Russian, like simple words, then little sentence and so on. And now I can read in Russian and I've never memorized a single character.
Yeah.
Obviously, if I read Dostoevsky, I can read the entire book, but I might not understand what he's talking about, but I can read it.
Yeah.
And I've never, because I always have that fight within myself. Like whenever someone tries to teach you a language in a traditional way, like lesson number one, the alphabet. And I'm always like, I don't think it's necessary to memorize it that way. And again, it makes some sort of sense with a language with 27 letters or 25, like our languages. But if you had to memorize 5,000, it just sounds too crazy. For that to be the way to learn it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, first of all, as opposed to the traditional / institutional way of learning, as you mentioned, the problem there is that you're forced to follow a system. Whereas when you're by yourself, you can do it according to your priorities. And it's the same with Japanese. Actually, you don't need to learn any characters if you don't want to. There is a system that's called Romaji, and it's basically the transcription in Roman alphabet. So you can definitely learn Japanese like that. Same with Chinese. There is the pinyin system. Yeah. So if you just want to learn how to read in pinyin, that's fine, and you'll be able to speak, because most of the people watching, their main purpose is to be able to understand and to speak. So you can get rid of that. But to be fair, there is still a lot of reading involved. And, you know, I got your point about different methods of learning, but that's the thing. So in Japanese, we have alphabets that are similar to the Latin one, which are the one that I the ones that I showed on my channel. And 5,000 characters, you're never going to be able to learn that one by one. You're going to be crazy. Right. So I think if I were to teach Japanese, I would still request to make an effort to learn maybe 50, 100 of them to understand how it works to start. And then after that, like you said, like more in a like subconscious way of learning, learning them one by one. And after maybe 5 years of studies, you'll realize that you know thousands of them, of the characters.
Right.
So, but yeah, I think it's very, very difficult to compare a language that uses Latin alphabet or just the same like kind of an alphabet that follows the same kind of structure compared to an Asian one when it's where it's completely different.
Yeah, it is. I mean, yeah, I'm just such a fan of subconsciously acquiring languages and comprehensible inputs, different crashing and so on. But like I said, I might take it to the extreme sometimes, but I'm going to have more fun that way. So that's why I do it, right? And that's why, that's the way I communicate it to people. But I don't know, I'm just thinking like the same way a parent tells a story to a kid and they have the book with the images. If you do that with an adult, that's my idea. If you do that with an adult, you tell a story that we all know, for example, I know, like Cinderella or Snow White or, you know, whatever it is. But even if you, at the beginning, like you said, you're only focused on listening, on understanding the oral part. When you can already understand stories orally, if someone's reading the same story to you at the same time, you're going to be able to figure them out subconsciously. Again, that's my point. Like, you know, so
yeah.
Once upon a time, you understand the concept of once upon a time, right? And you see the characters. But once you get enough exposure to it, obviously, like, again, it's not going to happen the first time around.
You need to
read 1,000 stories or as many as necessary. You're going to start realizing the patterns or the different characters and so on.
For sure.
Without your conscious control of it. That's my point. And to me, it sounds like a way more interesting way of learning something. That, again, back to my point of my hating anything that reminds me of the traditional way.
Yeah. You know?
Because that way I'm reading stories. And, you know, it just...
That's true. But do you know a method that works that way, or are you developing one? Because that could be very interesting. I'm sure you're not the only person who thinks like that.
Right. I mean, well, I actually was in France, so a couple of years I went to a conference in France, to a workshop in the south of France in Agen, where comprehensible teachers all over the world gathered to, you know, to share ideas about, you know, comprehensible input. They're mostly classroom teachers, right, with kids and so on. But there's some online teachers like myself and things like that. And I remember the second year, so basically in the mornings, we would be the students in someone else's class. So some teachers would teach a class, and the other teachers would be the students. And I remember attending a Chinese, like Mandarin Chinese class. And the teacher told us a story about, you know, Spider-Man meeting someone, like a simple fun story. And I believe it was the third class. So it was Monday to Friday, so on Wednesday. We've already talked about the story, just listening to it, right? No characters, nothing. But she wrote it down at home between the second and the third class. And on the third class, she read it to us. as she was telling it. So we knew the story. So Superman goes to the zoo and meets an elephant. It was like,
yeah, super. Yeah.
But because you already understand the meaning, you're connecting, okay, so this is Superman.
Or yeah.
Spider-Man. I just Superman, Spider-Man goes to the zoo. And because she's saying the words at the same time, and you recognize them because you know the story. Okay, so I think she used different colors for different characters, also to so goes to right. So this is a yellow character, Spider-Man. This is a red character, so you could recognize. Okay, red. So you know, in the same story, she would use Spider-Man several times, goes to several times. That was super simple because we were all complete beginners, right? But with enough repetitions of that, okay, so this is the character for Ghost 2. I'm making it up. I don't know how it works, but you know.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean.
Yeah. For sure, man. That sounds very efficient.
Yeah, I'm, you know, trying to see if there's anyone doing it that way or.
Also not that I'm aware of.
How native speakers learn. Or acquire the characters as well, right?
Well, that's a tricky question, because native speakers would still learn it at school and they would have exercises writing the characters over and over and over again.
Right.
So if you ask them, they'd say, you know, all the characters I learned in school when I was very young, maybe 5, 7, my first characters, even me, I was following the Japanese system. It's a program called Kumon. And that's the way we were taught. We had to write the characters over and over and over again. And at some point, you'd know them. So that's part of the Asian culture. So if you want to learn the way they do, even at a very young age, it's repetition. Is it efficient? I know that some studies have shown that not necessarily, but that's how we learn it in Asia.
Right. Yeah, but I knew that. But that's, there's always this conscious versus subconscious sort of debate because, again, even in my, like, even with Spanish, with my native language, it's the same thing. Yeah, like, we learn to read and write in school. We have those, like, summer notebooks that do M-A-M-E-M-E, you know?
Yeah.
But the thing is, because that's conscious, same for grammar.
Yeah.
That's conscious, so it's easier to measure. It's easier to give it the credit.
Right.
But we tend to forget, you know, those days in which your grandma, your mother read stories to you and you were reading at the same time. Because I'm thinking, I remember my parents told me several times, like, it wasn't necessarily the case for me, but with my brother, he started reading way sooner than his classmates.
Okay.
And they told me he would just read signs in the street like all the time. And they told me that they used to read to us aloud all the time, right? So again, it's easier to give traditional classes the credit because it's conscious, it's more tangible, you can measure it.
Yeah.
But how do you measure how many stories your grandma, your mom, your dad told you?
For sure.
While you were looking at the book. Perhaps that was the thing that helped you, but it's more difficult to measure it. You know what I mean?
It's true.
So
yeah.
Even with Japanese, they're memorizing, they're repeating, they're practicing, like you said. But perhaps at home they had an uncle who read them all the time, and you know the uncle went through the characters as he read it, and that's the thing that actually helped them the most.
Oh, for sure. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, it would be very difficult to quantify if it was more helpful than the actual traditional system. I wouldn't know. We need to study that. It would be very interesting, I'm sure. But yeah, of course. I mean, they bathe in the language, and sometimes that's the thing. They use a word, they still don't know how to write the characters, and once they see the characters, they associate the word directly to the character. So half of the work is already done. So it's subconscious. Oh, okay, well, I'm just learning the characters and it goes easier for them. That's for sure. Yeah. But no, I'd be very, like, if you conduct a study like that, I'd be very interested to see the results.
So yeah, it's such an interesting topic to me because, yeah, for me with Spanish, again, I've always been pretty good with writing and things like that, like pretty precise and so on. And it wasn't that I studied more than other students. Believe me, it wasn't that case.
Yeah.
I think I've always loved reading. Reading's always been emphasized at home for me and my brother. So I have the feeling that's the thing that actually helped me out, and my brother, and not because, you know, in school, we all get the same classes. We all get the same education, right?
True.
And yeah, some people study more than others, but I don't think there's a correlation between, you know, the ones who study the most and the ones who can write more precisely, or, you know, like I remember, like, it was like language or literature classes, like your own language, that they would just point out your mistakes, your grammar mistakes or your errors in the language. I remember I always had like very, very few of them. Like, you know, there would be people having like 10, 15, 20 in an exam. I would have one, two, or none most of the time. And I just have the feeling that's because of my reading.
Okay.
That's my whole point.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know what to answer to that. I guess we're all different and we all have like different ways of learning. Maybe also the fact that I was born in a bilingual environment made my brain work a different way. That would make language learning a bit different from what most people do or should do in order to be more efficient. But were you born, was it only Spanish at your house?
Yeah.
When you were growing up? Okay.
Yeah, French was just words here and there. And when we went to France, you know, I learned just by naturally being immersed in the house.
Yeah.
I would learn, you know, good morning, hi, you know, things like that.
But yeah, the immersion method is definitely one of the most efficient ones. So I recommend that. I mean, you mentioned like just listening and being, gathering yourself with, surrounding yourself with as much content as possible, podcasts, videos, living the language. I think it's very, I mean, anybody should do that. But yeah, it's very interesting, man. If you move forward with this, let me know. I'll be interested to learn more.
Absolutely. Yeah, I need to think of a way of, you know, conducting this or structuring. Yeah. or you know, start with a language like that myself. But the thing is, I need someone else. I need a teacher for that. It's not like learning Italian for me, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure.
With Italian, I could understand cartoons and things like that right away.
Yeah.
Japanese, even if it's the simplest sort of cartoons, I'm not going to understand because it's just noise to my ears.
Yeah.
But it's always more difficult because of that, because you need someone with a project on YouTube, or you need a tutor or, yeah. But
you know, it's funny because
I'll get to that.
but because the method you're mentioning, I think it's more, people would tend to do that more with online courses because they don't have time to test you. Like, I don't know if you give or if you've taken any one-on-one classes, but I don't think people follow up with you. You're a student paying for the classes, so you have to do your homework, and maybe they'll verbally ask you, oh, do you remember what we did last week? You never tested. So I guess online courses would be more using your method of learning more subconsciously, you know?
Well, I mean, what I do with my students is, well, like I said, we create stories, we play games, we do different things in class in a way that is comprehensible for them. So that's my main job, to make it comprehensible for them and as compelling as possible, of course.
Yeah.
That's why the stories, the games, and so on, because they're, we all communicate through stories. We all like some sort of games, right? But then what I do is I encourage them, first of all, to get exposed to the language on their own outside of the classroom. I give them ideas for, you know, just if they're beginners, I don't know, even cartoons or comic books, things that they can understand. Because at the end of the day, you know, 1-2 hours per week that we're having, I could be the greatest teacher ever.
Just kidding. Yeah.
But it's true. 2 hours, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm trying to encourage them to do. Like, you know, if you're listening to the language for 20 minutes a day outside of the class, that's 2-3 extra hours a week, and that's going to make a difference.
For sure. 100%.
That's what I try to do. And, you know, instead of testing, things like that, which, again, I immediately reject that. But it just, you know, and plus we're adults. I teach adults, right? So we're responsible. We're accountable for, you know, like, again, I'm fine with teaching you for 20 years, but I guess that's not your goal.
Right? Yeah. You need to see progress, and you have to study on your own, that's for sure. Yeah.
You know, if instead of 20 it's going to take you 2, you're probably going to be happier, right? But if we're having 1-2 classes a week, again, I could be the greatest teacher ever, but it's still little time for you to get there, right? So that's what I try to emphasize. Okay, so that was fun.
Yes, it was. Thank you again for the conversations, like, fascinating.
Yeah, I'm just so passionate about languages overall, like other cultures.
I can tell.
I was trying to think. And then, again, because, yeah, to wrap things up here, because I reject the traditional way, the conscious way so much, I'm always trying to think of ways, of ideas, to do it in a natural way, right? Because I feel like we all have the ability to learn languages because we all acquire a native language or languages in your case. Again, I'm not saying we should learn the same way. I'm not saying we should talk to adults like, hey, sweetie, you know, I don't mean that. But the principles that help us acquire native languages, to me, they should be the same because it's a process that works for every single one of us. But that's why I'm always... And, you know, you don't tell your 2-year-old kid, so this is the subjunctive, this is the, you know, that's my whole point. So that's why I'm always striving to, you know, for things, you know, to find things that make it more natural, more enjoyable. And because, like I said, for me, even in the short run, if I'm not enjoying it, it's not worth it because I'm going to end up giving up.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, thank you, like I said. And, yeah, I'll leave all the links to your YouTube channel or whatever you want me to leave a link to, like in the title, description, and everywhere.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you so much again for the invitation. It was very interesting. I learned so much. And so what's you're currently located in Poland? Are you giving classes there? Or what's the story behind that?
Online, actually. So I'm in Krakow in Poland because I love the city and yeah, but I teach online like 100%. So
okay,
that way I'm more flexible. I always go back to Spain for a month in the summer and I can do that and still teach. So yeah.
Okay, cool.
The way.
All right.
Actually, I discovered your content through the video in which you talked to the little kid in 5 different languages.
Oh, yeah, Ronnie.
And I actually had...
He's a teenager now.
I had his dad on the podcast 2 weeks ago.
Oh, no way, Tetsu. Yeah. Wonderful guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful father for that matter.
Yeah, and we're talking about, well, I mean, his crazy experience as a kid and with his kids and so on. Yeah,
he's dedicating his life for bringing the multilingual and multicultural kind of settings for his children. It's amazing. I admire him so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, yeah, thank you, everyone, for getting to this point. I hope it was interesting. Yeah, and thank you, Bong.
My pleasure.
Oh, the super fun conversation. Be well, everyone. Bye-bye. Thanks so much for watching this interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was helpful for you. And if you want to know more about language learning, language acquisition, like, you know, what's the best way to learn a language, ideas for language learning, the best resources at different levels, here you can find the whole playlist with all the interviews I've done so far with different researchers, teachers, polyglots, and so on. And finally, right here, you smash this guy right in the face to subscribe to my channel. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.